you had earlier sort of become class conscious.
Yes, my experience working under different conditions had made me so. I mean, I came from a working class family, and I
family that was
pro-union. Oh no, at least he was a liberal. He my dad I'm speaking of, but he was a saddler, harness maker. And I guess we get our independence going back a bit. My grandmother, who my grandmother came over. I'm not sure if it was she or her. No, I think it was her parents, her people anyway, came over on the Hector, boat Hector, from Scotland, and they were from the Highlands of Scotland. And the Hector, this was the first boat which brought Scotch settlers to Nova Scotia. And my grandmother, while she was alive, attended the 100th centenary of the arrival of that boat in Pictou. My grandmother lived till she was 97. Worked in her garden right up to the year before she died. So, anyway, that's just a little sidelight.
Okay. I was also going to ask, you said earlier that you were in favor of industrial organization rather than trade. How did you learn that or decide that?
Here, mostly, because we were organized according to trade, and I could see that we had a much better chance, for instance, in the in a hotel, if the chambermaids and so on, you know, everybody working in the hotel were all in the union with us. In fact, I think if I'm not mistaken, I think we did make an attempt to organize the chambermaids along with the other workers in the hotels. It was a little. We had to do it somewhat on the sly, meet them as they came out, sort of wait the hotel and this sort of thing, and we were unfortunately. We didn't complete the work at that time because of what happened subsequent to the to the convention, and which put the organization of the hotel workers back some time in BC here, because the. In our international, the bartenders' union were in the same international as we were, and we were some time before the end of the war. The president of the union had died, and the first vice president was acting president up to a few months before the convention. At which time, he. The executive appointed him president pro tem to go into the convention. As I could see it, was that being in office, he would have a better chance of being reelected. And of course, they represented reaction in union, and. Remember that behind this union was the racketeers. I mean, I don't mean that they supported the union, but go back into history and think of rum running and this. This was the liquor. All this is in represented this union, and the racketeers are making their first or a big. Bid to control labor, right, because they need to control labor, to control what's the word I want? I'm lost for words there. The money, this is where the big money, as far as racketeers were concerned, this is where the big money was connected with liquor. So that the first onslaught against labor following the war was made against us. And we, vice president, we had a Canadian vice president, and he... He went along with the inns, shall we say, and he toured Canada, came to every trade union, both in the bartenders and the restaurants where we were organized, wherever there would be delegates going to Milwaukee, to import us to impress on us that we must support the present officers. Now, but we knew of that there was quite a progressive group centered in around San Francisco and the West Coast, who were endeavoring to oust this group from office. And I'm trying to think, obviously now, things happened before the convention. And the man who was going to run against Ernst was the in man at the time. He had been ambushed on his way from somewhere. He was going home, and it just happened that his wife was driving the car, and she was killed. And he was badly, and this was about 2 weeks before the convention, he was badly injured, so that he was in the hospital, and I'll go get to the convention. That wasn't the only instance of gunfire. It was getting really, they meant business. Absolutely, we're dealing with the same. Now, we went, Emily Watts and I went as delegates from here, and there was I've forgotten her name, from Victoria, and we had taken it up in our unions, had told them what Johnson, who was our Canadian vice president, had wanted us to do. We explained the situation as we saw it. We asked them they told us to go down there and follow, you know, vote for the, go with the opposition to the inns. And when we got to Milwaukee, we gathered first, not in the hall where we were going to carry on, but I don't know whether the hall we were going to use wasn't quite ready, but whatever it was, we were, also we knew that there would be guns at that convention. And as it turned out, there were probably something like, there were about 1,400 delegates there, and there were probably close to 200 gunmen and what have you. We knew that if we won the vote, that somebody was going to pay for it. We were ready to, in the hall, I mean, to drop to the floor to avoid gunfire if it came, it could come to that. And anyway, I'm getting ahead of it a little bit, but this first meeting, we are in this hall and we're sitting at individual seats, and there seemed to be an awful buzzing going on, and I looked around and there were people all over the hall sort of going along, crouching down and talking to the delegates. And then this fellow came along and started, and of course, oh, I know now, McDonough was the name of the man we were supporting to go for president. And so a lot of us were wearing the McDonough pins. And we'd previously had a caucus meeting, a Canadian caucus meeting, and they tried to get us all to vote as one, put in one vote. And each union was each delegate, according to the membership of the union, was had carried so many votes, and we wouldn't agree to that. We wouldn't go along a solid vote. So which meant, and if within a union, one person could cast all the votes for the union if you agreed, the delegates agreed. If you didn't agree among yourselves, you had to get up. It wasn't anything like a secret ballot. You got up and declared your vote. Anyhow, so this fellow started talking to me, and he said, "What? A nice young lady like you wearing a McDonough pin for?" And this is how he started. And of course, right away my hackles were up, and he tried to cajole me, and then he got a little nasty, even threatening me. And then this was going on, I realized, all over the hall. And it had become so bad that they even decided to put a halt to it from the platform, and they asked everybody who didn't have accredited membership, etc., to leave the hall so they could get down to business. And that was the first indication we got there. And then meetings went on. We had discussions and.
It had to do with
policy, yes, but mainly what they were concerned was the. Of course, it was on issues. I don't remember the issues so much as I remember the general atmosphere, the general. They wanted to re-elect those who were then in office, because they were obviously in the hands, one way or another, of the racketeers.
So was one of the issues like union democracy in terms of having a right to run your own union?
Yes, that would be one of them. You see, because this was like dictatorship coming down from the top, and we were asked to go along with that. Mm-hmm. It was about what it amounted to. Mm-hmm. So we carried on through the week and meetings, and I remember the highlights, or the results rather than what we discussed. I remember when it came to Friday, there was to be the elections on Friday afternoon, and Friday morning there had been discussions. We were threatened from the platform that if we didn't fall in line, and they were speaking directly to us from Canada, from the west of Canada and from the west coast, particularly, that if we didn't conform, we didn't fall in line, we'd be sorry. And it was unbelievable. When we came back and told the story at the Trades and Labor Council, I know that many of them thought we were romancing, thought we, I don't know what they thought, but they certainly didn't, it was too soon after the war yet for the workers generally to realize what could happen, what was happening already. And, but I remember there was a young delegate from Quebec who had, there was a small union, and he, Johnson had been to their local as he had to all the others, and they had agreed to go down there and do as Johnson wanted them to do. But when he saw what was happening and listened to the discussions, which had gone very heated at times, mics were shut off, and people, if they didn't want to listen to you or didn't want you to be heard, all the things that happened were just out of this world. Well, after this morning of discussion and before the election, I'm not quite clear whether it was before the election or whether, no, it was after that. It was the election itself. After the morning discussion, he felt he couldn't go along with the old line, the powers. And he wired his union and told them, just in a few words, that it wasn't as they had thought it was. What should he do? And they wired him back and told him to do as he saw fit. So that he voted with what they call the progressives for McDonough. And when he was so upset, because after I'm not quite clear whether it was he had voted or whether he'd spoke, but he had declared himself anyway. And as a result, a man who was definitely an agent, and he had been sitting up, he had bothered us from time to time, and he came down onto the floor of the convention and started to berate him, tear him down for what he was doing, what he was saying. I guess the vote hadn't taken place yet, and it was the way he was talking. And so it was, it was so blatant, so noticeable that this man was finally ordered off the floor. And this young chap from Quebec was so upset that when we had the noon recess, he didn't come back after. And we really were concerned. We didn't know whether he had been followed and attacked or what. And we knew these things could happen. And but finally, about 2 o'clock, he came back, and he had gone out so quickly when the recess was called, noon recess was called, that they hadn't been able to follow him, apparently. And he'd gotten off by himself and sort of walked off his anguish, and he'd come back for the vote. That was it. But when we reconvened in the afternoon, McDonough came into the... Now, wait a minute. McDonough wasn't the one who was to be elected. I was a little wrong there. McDonough was the one who was spearheading the fight for the election of the progressive of this person against the old line, and that was. But he had his fight had been that good that's why he had been attacked before. But he came to the convention accompanied by a doctor, a nurse, and two bodyguards, which was spectacular in itself. I mean, he really wasn't supposed to be out. But he came there specifically to nominate the person who was to run against the old line. That was it. And of course, we put on quite a welcome when he came in. It was, the highlights of that convention were just, it makes me shiver and makes my blood run cold at times, even now thinking about it, you know. and this was when we knew that when those votes would be counted, and there was no way they could, because the vote, you voted openly, you got up, declared your vote. there was not too many votes between the two. The old line got in by a few votes, and then they put on a display that made me think of fascist Germany. The group who were working hardest for the old line, they got up, maybe a couple hundred of them, maybe not quite that many, seemed like a lot. They got pans. I don't know, they must have had the things ready. But they paraded around the hall. This one fellow led them, this one, and beating these drums and makeshift drums and what have you, making an, that just, I thought, my God, is this what it was like in Germany before the war? I guess there must have been such things. Anyway, finally, the convention is over, and we return home. And it was only a matter of a few months after that that Johnston came into the hall one day. And like I said, we had just completed the best agreement that had ever been signed in Canada, and had it signed by most of the restaurant workers, and we were in the process of organizing in the hotels. And Johnston came in and said he had asked me to hand over the keys, that he was appointed by the International, that the union was put under trusteeship, and he was there to handle it and to appoint officers to operate it. I think Johnston heard a few truths about them, because if anyone ever got a calling down, he did. I just let him have it. However, while this was going on, I got the stamp out of the drawer and put it in my purse, and came immediately over to North Vancouver, where Emily Watts was living, and we talked. She signed a check. We had to both sign the check, you see, so that I withdrew all the money, the reunion money, from the bank before they got to it, and put it in the hands of a lawyer. And I went back, and I agreed, then she was to call an executive meeting for that night. And I forgotten, I went back over to, oh yes, I went back to go to the bank and get the money, etc., and do a few other things. And then we had the executive meeting that night, and we were going to fight them.
you know what year was this town? Was this 1948?
This is 46. Okay. Could have been into 47, because it was some months. 46 was the convention.
Right.
And whether this was later in the year or early in 47, I'm not quite clear. And, now, one of the things Johnson told me, he said, well, if we just handed things over and went and acted like good little girls, nothing would happen to us. We would remain members, etc., etc., etc. And I had no intention of remaining a good little girl, nor had Emily or a few others of us. Because the organizer after the executive meeting, we wanted to call a union meeting, but we couldn't do it openly, so we had there were shop stewards in every house, and we I'm holding this a bit too far. We the organizer took the hotels and I took the restaurants and started to go from restaurant to restaurant, and when I was going into the second restaurant, I thought somebody was following me. So I've forgotten what I did, some way movements I made, that I, when I came out of there, I realized I was being followed. So I went right from there to a restaurant where I knew how I could get out the back way, and just walked in and sat down, had a cup of coffee, and then went down to the back, one of the back booths, and this man came in and sat down at the counter. And while he was there, I slipped out the back and slipped away and went on about my work. But we had a Sunday meeting. We called the Sunday meeting, and we made arrangements with them whereby they would know if any messages sent out, how to identify whether that was really sent by us, mm-hmm. and not in our name. And we'd made arrangements. And at that meeting, we'd agreed to carry on and fight for our autonomy and our right to run our own affairs within the. So. Then we made plans after the Sunday meeting to take back the Union Hall. They had had the, because I still had the key with me, they'd had the locks changed. And we, Monday morning, when they came to the office, they couldn't get in. Yet there was no sign of how we had gotten in. That had been, that had taken a few hours of a couple of boys working. I don't know how they did it, but they somehow removed the door. and we got in, and then, of course, when we were in, we put a chair at the door, and we had a couple of boys, two or three boys from the beverage dispensers in the back room, too, and then that was when we hit the front page of the papers. Then because, for instance, it was in our constitution that you didn't divulge your activities, your etc. business to the press, and yet. When this happened, when they came and found they couldn't get in and realized what had happened, that we were there, we were in possession, within minutes, photographers and reporters and so on were in the hall. Now, so they had been tipped off, and to which was completely against the bylaws. And They tried to get us out, and almost succeeded. Emily was going to go down the elevator. I'd have forgotten what the pretext was, And I went out and I grabbed her. I said, "What do you think you're doing?" I said, "What do you think they're doing?" And I pulled her back in. We locked the door again. And that's when that was the picture they got when they went got in the front pages that time. And but we knew that we couldn't hold the office. We knew they'd get a court order. But mainly what we wanted to do was get the a copy of the addresses, names and addresses of members. In fact, we took the records and we took them to the lawyer's office and we made copies there. And then I sat and erased every address and phone number from the records because I knew they would get a court order to repossess the records. This was all just, these were all, I can hear that lawyer laughing now. He just didn't know a thing what was going on, you know, but he's laughing in the other room. And that's just a little, but these are just little things. The long and short of it was, of course, that now we had been bad girls, etc., and so we had to go before a labor court, a court. You talk about a kangaroo court.
Was that because the international had, like, more power authority over the local?
Right. We had very little actual autonomy, particularly in the AFL, because I know that changed vastly since then, but I couldn't tell you what the situation is now. That's the way it was then. And
so you were in front of the labor board?
No. This is a court set up by the international. They had somebody come from Seattle, from the local there, and some from the beverage dispensers, and I've forgotten now just who all was on that group. And I was expelled, and both Emily and I were expelled. A year later, Emily was, we decided that one of us probably could get back in again, and at that time we decided it should be Emily. She did get, because we could appeal it after a year. And Emily did get back in the union after a year. But which meant, of course, the end of the the organization in the hotels at that particular time. And as I say, it was just fortunate that we had just completed the restaurant. There were still a few restaurants at that time that weren't in the union, but we were in the process of getting them in. But it did give a setback to the organization for quite some time.
How did the membership react to this whole process?
Oh, this is another thing. Eventually, we realized that the membership, while those who were at that Sunday meeting were solidly with us, that on the whole, the membership was pretty well split down the middle on the question, and which meant that that this group, because we had withdrawn as a union from the international, but which would have meant that about half the union would have been on the outside and half the members still on the inside, and we felt that to split them like that wasn't in the interest of the workers, and we. Held another meeting and discussed it, and it was decided that as a group they would remain members of the international union, and we were out of it as individuals.
Did they protest when it happened to you?
Oh yes. Those were Well, I wasn't exactly a heavyweight then, but I remember during that period, a few weeks of losing about 20 pounds. So you know the stresses we were under, the activity and all. But it's too bad that I didn't. I know that I had a lot of notes, and I haven't been. And I don't know where they are now. I've looked at different times, and they, of course, could very easily have become lost. I will show you a picture. No, that had nothing to do with that. I was going to show you the picture of just about 50 years ago, less a couple of months, when we, that's the high school group. But all in all, they never lost ground completely. I mean, the work we had done was the basis of work that was carried on later.
You people, from what I understand, in part talking to like Jim Morrison, he said that you and Emily were really instrumental in getting the restaurant organized.
Right, right.
Yeah, that you were the people who were most.
Yes, yes, yes.
Can you talk a bit about the organizing campaign in the restaurant and how that went, kind of working and what kind of servicing you needed to do?
Well, in most cases, it meant talking to the people off the job, naturally. And we would have to, once you got one person in a restaurant, and very often it was because in a restaurant already organized, they knew somebody in another restaurant and used every means of getting a contact in another restaurant. And of course, we went after the major restaurants to begin with, but we didn't bypass the little ones. Sometimes there were only two or three workers in a restaurant, and we organized the kitchen staff along with them in most cases. And sometimes it was difficult where there were Chinese in the kitchen. I don't recall that we ever recruited a Chinese into the union, but they were by no means antagonistic. In fact, they were, you know. But I guess they had their own reasons for not joining a union at that time. It meant a lot of night work. Well, because most people worked, like the waitresses, worked till after dinner, for instance, and you would meet them coming off the job. And then there were the later shifts. And sometimes you could go into a restaurant and sit at a counter and talk to some of them. In some cases, the employers weren't. In many cases, the employers weren't anti-union. They didn't care too much one way or the other, but some of them were quite. Quite anti-union, because they realized that it would mean regulation on wages and hours and conditions. So I think I should mention one employer or group of employers. I don't know whether, I think they're dead now, but originally there was a Love's restaurant on Granville Street, and the Fish and Oyster Bar was almost directly across. And the Fish and Oyster Bar was operated by one of the Love boys and a brother-in-law. And they were very much, they were pro-union. Now why, I don't know. I don't know what their background was. But we certainly received their support, and they went right along with the fact that, with the fact of what we were fighting for was closed shop in a union house. A lot of the employers had the idea they didn't mind the union too much if they didn't have to have union members, if they didn't have to belong. But of course, that was one of the in this agreement we had finished that it they could, if there wasn't a union person available for a job, they could hire non-union, but they were required to join the union within a certain period of time. And that, at that time, was quite a progressive step, particularly in the hotels and restaurants. I don't know. That was the period of just where a lot of legislation was the unions and the union leadership were responsible for a lot of union of the labor legislation. That was the period of the real beginning of getting the whole idea of minimum wage, the question of hours, workman's compensation improved, and all of this legislation that we today take for granted.
Also, did I guess during the war, also the right to organize was established.
Yes.
Did that make a difference?
Oh yes. Oh, well, whereas before, goons could be used, and I myself didn't come in contact with this, but I've known of it happen in back east and places and so on, that was now against the law. The worker was protected, was given the right to join the union of his choice by legislation, and somewhere in that period, I mean, time-wise, I'm mixed up with what happened then, what happened subsequently. But the question of the labor board being set up and being able to, if you had a majority belonging to a union in a house, or as we used to call it, or on a job, then the employer was required to recognize the union and to negotiate an agreement to cover. Because previous to that time, closed shop was practically unknown, except that the beverage dispensers had that pretty well.
Uh-huh. So could you use their contract as a basis to look at it?
Not particularly, because conditions were varied, you know, different work, I suppose we took some things. We took whatever was good from any other agreement.
Did you go into the restaurants and organize?
Yeah.